Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome to Lost in the Static, everybody. I am your host, Scott.
Co-host.
I'm your host, and then I have this hanger on just sitting next to me every week. Just here to bitch about stuff that everybody loves.
It's sickening, really.
Yes, it is.
Do the Adam and Eve promo then, host.
All right, fine. If you go to adamandeve.com and you do us a favor at the very end when you're checking out, you use the promo code STATIC, S-T-A-T-I-C, then you get 50% off of a single item, 3 free DVDs, free shipping in the U.S., and a mystery gift. Also, we have links at 1201beyond.com that you can go to Amazon if you're going to buy something through Amazon. It doesn't save you any money or get you any special deals, but it does give us a tiny sliver of a cut of whatever you buy, and you'll be helping out the show that way.
Mm-hmm. And so let's tonight we've got a special interview with coming up, you know, in a little bit in the show, but let's talk about franchises and licenses. Now, what a lot of people probably don't realize is when they read the comic books for Star Wars or Star Trek or play the video games or whatnot, just how stringent what you can and cannot do with licensed characters is.
Right.
So do you think that these companies don't understand what they have with licensed characters, and that if they would allow somebody to, quote, go off the reservation, that they might open up a whole new audience? Or do you think they're overprotective by going, no, you can't do that. That'll wreck the character for the movie that we're trying to make in 5 years.
Well, let's be honest. We've discussed before that the movies in the continuity in the movies and stuff like that, directors have the ability. Lucas did this with Star Wars to go, okay, all the continuity in the comic books and all the expanded universe stuff gone. And
well, yeah,
here's the movie we want.
Paramount straight out said for Star Trek, if it doesn't happen in one of the TV series or on the movies, it didn't happen. That all the comic books, all the novels, all the video games, those are, their words, make-believe. Yeah. As if the TV shows weren't make-believe, right?
It's fan fiction, really. I mean,
but that's licensed fan fiction.
I was going to say, that's what licensed characters are. They're basically fan fiction that you gained the rights to write and get money for.
Well, then what do you consider the difference between, say, something new and a novelization? For instance, you know, back before most of these things got their own comic books and whatnot, we would buy the novelization of, say, Return of the Jedi, which in some cases would be radically different than the movie because they have to work off of a earlier draft of the script, which tends to not be the shooting script.
Right.
And they always go, well, see, that scene, it might have been in the novelization. That scene didn't appear in the movie, so it technically didn't happen.
Right.
So would you call novelizations license? Would you put that in the fan fiction area or not? Where would you qualify novelizations?
Okay, novelizations are just that. They're novelizations. You're taking a working print of a script.
What you know at that time to be the final script.
What you know at that time to be the final script. And you're novelizing it. You're making a story out of it instead of just going, here's the script, everybody, enjoy. You can go, here's the script with some narration. which is kind of what a novelization is. Here's a script with, you know, a little bit more scene description and stuff like that. And versus fan fiction or even licensed fan fiction is either taking a look at a given story. For instance, if we were to tell Star Wars A New Hope from the point of view of
A TIE fighter pilot
or something like that, or, you know, the
Grand Moff Tarkin.
There you go, Grand Moff Tarkin. And if we were to tell the story from his point of view, well, that's fan fiction because you're going outside of script at that. And it's not uncommon, hi, Cat, and it's not uncommon for fan fiction writers to do that and add scenes that we don't see and tell backstories that aren't necessarily in the script. Or if you take a given character and you write a story about, let's stick with Star Wars. You write a story about in between Empire and Jedi. And you talk about Luke and Leia being lovers. Well, that's fan fiction.
It's actually going to kind of come up in our interview.
Right. You know, that's fan fiction. And
But my question that I'm going to ask you now is, the definition of novelization is that as well. The definition of novelization is books or written works based on existing characters. So no, wouldn't that mean even the expanded universe would all be novelizations as well?
No, because a novelization, again, is taking an existing script and rewriting the same happenings that go on in that script.
What about when they deviate? And I mean a lot. For instance, there's a current hubbub going on the internet right now about a writer who wrote some, quote, original Friday the 13th novels in the 90s. Okay? And he is trying to claim that he was the first one to do this kind of thing. Look at the novelization, that's what it's called, of Friday the 13th Part 3. It's only got 10% in common with the actual Friday the 13th Part 3, to the point where they actually commissioned a second novelization because the first one strayed so far from the script that it was essentially an original work.
Then the first one shouldn't have been called a novelization. It's not.
Right, but this author is making the distinction. It's called a novelization, so it didn't happen, and it doesn't matter that it came before mine. Mine were first. It's like, no, not really. You know, same thing with Dark Shadows. Remember Dark Shadows had tons of books printed in the 70s after they were off the air? Sort of the Night Stalker, Star Wars, Star Trek. Jesus, they had a ton.
Oh, yeah.
By the dictionary definition, are those not novelizations?
No, they're not.
Like I said, that's the distinction we're looking for.
Yeah, and the distinction I'm telling you is a novelization is writing a book form of an existing script. And if that one that you mentioned, the Friday the 13th one, only had 10% in common,
it went way off reservation.
That's not a novelization. That is an expanded universe piece of fiction.
What about then when you adapt, say a movie adapts a classic novel like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep or Monkey Planet?
Okay.
And they call it a novelization. They even put the movie's poster on the book. But if you've ever read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep and watched Blade Runner, you'll go, maybe 20-25% in common. Monkey Planet, even less with Planet of the Apes. Those are called novelizations.
They shouldn't be called novelizations. They should be called novels upon which the work was based.
That's a little wordy for advertising lingo, though, Scott.
You know, either that or you go, the novel that inspired.
Okay, that's a little easier.
Yeah, Monkey Planet, the novel that inspired Planet of the Apes.
Because I've got a Planet of the Apes paperback. It's actually Monkey Planet, you know, where they've got ray guns and jetpacks and everything.
Right, right.
But it's got Heston on the cover, and I'm like, you are really mis-selling this book, man, because this is not an adaptation of the Heston Planet of the Apes.
Right. I mean, you could see, for me, you could have Monkey Planet
by Pierre Boulle.
Monkey Planet. Is that M-O-N-K-I-E, by the way? Or
oh, shut up. Anyway. I did that to be funny.
But you could have Monkey Planet, the novel that inspired Planet of the Apes, and you can also have the novelization of Planet of the Apes. Novelizations, by definition, are a reworking of an existing script. Therefore, they must come after the script, at least.
Well, I've even got one with The Running Man. It's got Arnold on the cover, and it's, you know, The Running Man logo from the movie. It's the original Bachman/King Running Man story, which, again, is so different from the movie. I go, that's not a novelization. You just released the original story again with a new cover.
Yeah, that's not a novelization. Yeah, and I don't see a problem with releasing with a new cover. Just to, you know, just don't.
But
call
to sell it,
it
as, hey, this is the movie book.
Yeah. Well, and again, do they sell it as the novel that inspired, or do they sell it as the novelization of
Running Man, the novel, you know, and it's got Arnold on the cover in his Running Man costume. You kind of go,
well, Running Man, the novel, I can let that one slip because it is Running Man, the novel, which.
Well, like my Blade Runner one. It is Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? That is the book.
Okay.
But it is called Blade Runner and has Harrison Ford on the cover. And I'm going, okay, now you're just lying.
Yeah, that's a little misleading.
Because I have a paperback of that.
Because and frankly, the story Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep are far superior.
To a degree, I like certain things that Blade Runner did differently, and I like certain things that, to me, one is not better than the other, but they kind of feed off of each other. So that's one of those really weird down the middle of the line ones.
And I much prefer the story. Oh, okay. Yeah, I can. I really, really like Blade Runner, the movie. I really do. I like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and you're right, they're about equal, but you know, the novel just edges it out for me. One where you want to talk about going off reservation, let's look at iRobot.
Now, do you mean iRobot, the movie that was never made from Harlan Ellison, or the iRobot Will Smith movie?
I mean I can't remember what Harlan Ellison called the short story upon which iRobot was.
The short story was part of the Caves of Steel,
right?
But by okay. Asimov, and then he basically created an original universe based on what Asimov laid down.
I'm talking about the one that was released, Will Smith.
Okay, yeah, that Ellison had nothing to do.
Very,
with that.
Very different from the story, and
almost nothing in common.
Very little in common, other than a robot is accused of murder. It ends there.
You sure you don't want to get some Nike product placement in there?
Book is far, far superior. Short stories. And, what was the story that AI was based on? The teddy bear specifically.
I know which one you're talking about, too. The title's escaping me, but.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But again, that's one where the short story is far superior to the film.
For one thing, it's not padded to 2.5 fucking hours.
For one.
That's one great aspect of that.
Yeah, it still has the blue fairy though.
Yeah, well,
but
or even something like it, something as good as Total Recall. I'm talking 1990, not that new thing.
You're talking about the Schwarzenegger one.
Yeah,
and the new one wasn't that bad.
Yes, it was. That new one was fucking awful on every conceivable level.
It wasn't that bad. It wasn't great, but it wasn't that.
I hated every second I was watching that thing. But the original We Can Remember It For You Wholesale is maybe 20% the same as the movie.
Yeah.
So when they re-released the short story of We Can Remember It For You Wholesale with Arnold on the cover, they sold it as a novelization again.
And that's misleading. That, to me, that's not a novelization. That is the novel or the short story that inspired blah.
And see, like what I was trying to tell that Friday the 13th author was, I know you want your stuff to be the first, but it wasn't. Just accept it. You know, stop. Because his thing is, Friday the 13th Part 3 is called a novelization, therefore that's what it is. I don't care if it's totally different. They used the word novelization. So therefore I win. No, you don't.
That's tricky. We're getting into legal territory.
It's word game territory.
Yeah, we're like I said, we're getting into lawyer territory there. So
let's move on to other kind of licenses. For instance, like comic books. You know, like we've got an interview coming up. I'll just spoil it. It's with Peter David. Great writer. Well, Peter David has worked for many of licensed characters. He's worked for Disney. He's written Little Mermaid comics. He's worked for Marvel, DC. He's written for Star Wars, Star Trek, etc. And in the interview, you'll hear he's had some issues with, well, you can't do that, but okay, that's okay. You know, it all depends on the franchise. He says some. They don't tell you, you know, as long as you don't, like, make the character gay, you can do whatever you want, you know?
Yeah, go run, enjoy, have fun.
Yeah.
You're the writer. We're going to let you write.
Yeah. Well, and really, Star Wars is the only one that he ran into issues with, but he'll talk about that. But what do you think, like, if you were given a franchise and you were going to write something, let's differentiate between fan fiction and we hired you to write this. Because I do think there is a difference.
There is. But there is a difference. But again, for me, if you write something and that something gets published and people buy that something and you get a check and you use that check to pay your electric bill. If you do that 3 times in a row, then and only then will I call you a professional writer. If you can't get your pay, you know, if you're getting paid some, if you can't pay your bills, you're not a professional writer. And there is a difference between a company going out and finding a professional writer like our guest and
Peter David.
Thank you. I knew that. I don't know why my mouth would not form the words.
He has Peter two, David. He's one of those guys with two first names.
Yes. Ironically, his middle name is Gefilpapunk.
I hope that sticks.
But nonetheless, if you are a company with a franchise, if you're Disney and you've got Little Mermaid and you go out and you seek out a writer to write something, that to me sets the writer apart from somebody who really, really likes My Little Pony and writes and let's leave the slash fiction and the sexual. I'm leaving the sexual fan fiction out of it. If somebody is a really, really big MLP fan and they write a story that could technically happen on the show and everybody's within character, but they don't get paid for it and maybe even get a C&D from
there's Lauren Faust, also the fact that you don't have the license.
Right.
For instance, there's one out there. For instance, let's say you take two franchises and cross them over and you don't have the licenses from either, but you try and sell it as real.
It's still fan fiction. Even if you sell it as real, even if everything, that's still fan fiction, you're still for a C&D.
Well, this Friday the 13th writer, who always insists he does not write fan fiction, by the way,
okay,
wrote a fifth Friday the 13th novel that he distributes for free, which is the Friday the 13th, the TV series characters finding Jason's mask as a haunted artifact. Doesn't have the licenses from either of those from Paramount, but he insists he does not write fan fiction.
Don't get me wrong, that's a great premise for fan fiction.
That was supposed to be on the series anyway. The series finale of Friday the 13th was supposed to be them finding Jason's mask, so he just took an unused concept from the TV series. Wow, how original.
But I don't. It's a good premise for whatever media it's in and might be interesting, but nonetheless.
You know, fiction has this stigma to it, Scott.
Okay.
Why do you think it does? Why do you think so many people, because what that Friday the 13th author is doing, I've heard from other authors who have worked with licensed properties, and they always insist, it's not fan fiction. It's not. It's not. Why are they so ardent that it's not?
It's because fan fiction has a stigma of being written by fans. And
but wouldn't fans, that by definition?
No, hang on. Fans are not always good writers. And so the glut of fan fiction that's out there is either A, some basement dweller's sexual fantasies laid down on paper or in electronic form, or B, weird things where people don't stay in characters and things that the creators of the show, series, or property...
Like all of a sudden aliens coming down to Miami Vice. Yeah. Oh, wait, that actually happened.
Well,
shit.
Well, you know, things that where they don't want to go. Let's say somebody writes My Little Mermaid.
is that the ponies as sea ponies?
There we go. Sea ponies. My Little Mermaid. They're seahorses.
We just came up with a new stupid idea.
There we go. But you know, they do a My Little Pony crossover with Little Mermaid, and all of a sudden you have Ariel acting out of character. And you have things that may not have happened in the story and everything like that. Well, if it's fan fiction, and if people call it fan fiction, then all of a sudden it's not canon. And that's another thing is but that's what licensing is about, is people going, okay, this is fan fiction that is now canon.
But to be fair, though, fan fiction, wouldn't you want a fan to officially write that? Like, if you were licensed, if you licensed a comic book of Little Mermaid, wouldn't you want somebody who's a Little Mermaid fan to be writing that?
Yeah,
I would. Instead of somebody who's like, I don't know what this is.
I would want a professional writer who is a Little Mermaid fan.
But
that
then
would be
isn't
ideal.
It the same thing as fan fiction? I mean, technically it is, because they're a fan who's writing fiction.
No, because with fan fiction, also me as the property holder, I don't have the right to go to a fan and while they're writing it and say, no, it's only once they start charging for it or... It has to do with controlled distribution, control of the final product, et cetera, et cetera.
Also sales, because that was one of the things that this is pre-Disney buying Star Wars. There was a fan fiction writer, and she called herself that, who wrote some Star Wars novels that were really popular. Well, she was charging people for them on Amazon. That's where Lucasfilm went, whoa. Yeah. We're pretty cool about letting people do this whole fan thing.
Yes.
You don't get to make money off of it, though, that we didn't authorize.
Right.
No.
Right. It's control of funds. It's control of your property. It's control of distribution. That's the difference between being a professional writer and adapting or writing or novelizing or blah, 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 and fan fiction. So there you go.
But then why does this come up so often that when they give the license to whatever characters, whatever universe, they often let the quote-unquote expanded universe or extended universe, or like what in comic books they call Elseworld stories, happen with that specific, it's make-believe, this didn't actually happen, then why do you think they bother? Is it just commerce that we want to sell a couple of more comic books? Because I'll be honest, a lot of the times, the Elseworld stuff, when it comes to comics... is way more ballsy, edgy, and interesting than the official continuity, which is boring and safe.
But you can control the official continuity. And you have direct control of the official continuity. And as we can see in this interview, you have direct control of your characters when you license it.
Right.
So I'll tell you what, Josh, before we
get too far
into this, let's go ahead and go to that interview.
Okay.
Here is Josh, who had the pleasure of talking to Peter David.
And we didn't just talk about this. I also talked to him about his working with Full Moon, his comics, and some of his unpublished works. But I had Peter David on the line. I wasn't going to not ask him that shit, people.
Can't blame you.
You've had a career that expands since the first thing I remember reading from you was in the 80s. Do you look back at your early work and kind of go, wow, what was I thinking? Or, damn, I was dead on right then, too.
Oh, no. I look up on my early stuff and all I can see are the flaws. But then again, I look at most of my stuff and all I can see are the flaws. I have very little work that I would look back on and say, wow, I got that absolutely right. So, yeah, I tend to look at the early 80s stuff and all I can see is the stuff that I would never do now.
When you do that, do you kind of wish that, because we're going to get into some of your lost works in a moment, do you kind of wish that some of those were lost works? I like seeing the progression of a writer, and...
Right.
I'll say even when I see your really early stuff, it feels like Peter David, even if it's early Peter David.
No, I don't wish that anything would go away. I mean, I'm proud of everything that I've done. You know, there's stuff that I feel that I could do much better now. I indeed had that opportunity. For example, when Nightlife was republished by Ace Books, we were originally just going to republish the original novel. And I was going to go through it and make some adjustments to make it more modern day. And by that, I figured what I would do is, you know, for example, substitute computers every place. I had people doing typewriters, that kind of thing. But as I read the manuscript, as I read the original manuscript, I was struck by all the things that I felt where the book was coming up short and a place where I did shortcuts because I didn't know how to do it right. So I wound up doing a heavy rewrite on the manuscript to such a degree that the original manuscript was 65,000 words and the rewritten one was 95,000 words. So I wound up resulting in two more books because I came up with so much additional material to put in. So it's, you know, writing is a continuing learning process. if you look at stuff that you did 20, 30 years ago and you're completely satisfied with it, chances are there's something wrong with the writing or wrong with you.
Now, my favorite run of yours, I know everyone's going to say the Hulk, and I don't disagree that your Hulk run is a great run. I got to go with the run you did on Dreadstar. I think I absolutely loved it. And you had a perfect example of the kind of humor that I thought you injected into Dreadstar was what was basically a throwaway joke that I thought was so brilliant. Two aliens were like looking at a planet or something, and they said, it's like 9,000 gleeble globs away. And then that little asterisk said, that's like 14,000 bleens.
Yes.
And I thought that joke was brilliant that you translated gobbledygook into other gobbledygook.
Other gobbledygook. Well, that's because it has become such a trope in comic books that they would come up with these fictional units of measurement and then have little captions that indicated what it corresponded to in human measurement. And I always thought that was such a complete waste of time. I mean, who do you think you're fooling here? You know? So I thought it would be funny to have a unit of measurement and have it transcribed to another unit of alien measurement, so you still would actually have no freaking clue how far it was. And I remember doing that. That was fun.
I just thought that was, and it was such a like a throwaway gag that I thought perfectly exemplified the new style, because your Dreadstar run, at least to me, was so different than the Luke McDonnell and Jim Starlin stuff that had come before it. Was that a specific conscious choice that you wanted to make it lighter and more fun, or how did that happen? And did you get in any kind of interference from Jim Starlin since they were his?
No interference whatsoever. Jim gave me total carte blanche to do whatever I wanted. I, to this day, have no idea why in God's name Jim thought that I would be a good person to follow him on Dreadstar, because my writing style is 180 degrees from Jim's. And I really have no idea, unless he just wanted someone to take it in a wildly different direction. And he said to me, I want you to come on this book and write whatever you want to write. And he insisted on, I think like once or twice he asked about stuff that I was planning, mostly because he was just curious as to where I was going. Not because he was planning to counterman me or anything, but he was just curious to know what I was doing and loved it every time that I told him. But yeah, Jim could not have been more supportive.
The one thing that I get from people when I see them going over these is just how much of a stark difference it is almost right off the bat. Because the Luke McDonnell era, I enjoyed it. I'm not complaining about it. But it was dark. It was heavy. And then your stuff was much lighter and fun. You didn't really make a big transition period. You just kind of like, all that dark, heavy stuff is over. Did fans react well to that? Because I admit, I didn't read these when they were new. I got all these after the fact, so I don't know what the reaction was when these were first coming out.
I honest to God don't remember. I hope they did. But, you know, this was like 30 years ago. I barely remember stuff I wrote 30 years ago, much less what somebody wrote about what I wrote 30 years ago. Plus, it was really before the prevalence of the internet, where you can find out what everybody's thinking within minutes of the book coming out. I honestly don't remember any fan letters. First got them, I don't think they sent them to me. So I have no idea what the fan reaction was. I hope they liked it.
And then let's use Dreadstar to move into the Lost Works. Now, when Dreadstar was canceled, first kind of went under relatively quickly. There was the 1994 miniseries, which I enjoyed quite a bit. Planet Skeevo was just awesome. But
thank you.
I see on your webpage you have a Lost Work of The Fall series. Is that essentially what we got in 1994, or was it something totally different?
The Fall? I have no idea what that is.
It's listed on your webpage as a Lost Dreadstar story.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Maybe it was the very last story that I was planning to do, but I don't think that was going to be a limited series or anything.
PeterDavid.net, Dreadstar The Fall. This would have been a 3-issue miniseries continuing the Dreadstar storyline from the monthly series. First comics went out of business before the miniseries could be published. It is unknown how much of the art was completed.
To the best of my knowledge, none of the art was completed. I don't even remember writing it.
I'm just going off your webpage because I didn't know about that
one. I believe you.
Which,
I have no recollection of the full. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, and then that brings us into, you've got a lot of lost or unpublished works. Does it kind of bother you that you work so hard on these things? I mean, I know you get paid for it regardless, but that the audience is never going to be able to see, like, the Nightmare on Elm Street stories you wrote or anything like that?
Well, it's a little frustrating, but I really don't have any place to be upset about it because there's lots of people out there who work just as hard on stuff, and none of their stuff gets out. I mean, there are people who work on screenplays, dozens and dozens, hundreds, thousands of screenplays that people work on and nobody ever sees the screenplays. People work on novels and the novels never get published. I mean, at least I'm fortunate enough to be able to get my work out there. I don't see how I really have the right to be bitchy or cranky because some of my work didn't get out to the audience. I mean, do I regret that some of the stuff didn't get out there? Yeah, I'm frustrated that nobody will ever see the Nightmare on Elm Street stories because I thought they were perfectly fine and perfectly entertaining. It's probably my greatest frustration. The thing that didn't see print that still bugs me to this day was my Star Wars script. I loved my Star Wars script. Dark Horse commissioned me to do a 4-issue series called Star Wars Splinters, and essentially alternate reality versions of Star Wars. The challenge was to take a moment in Star Wars and have it zig instead of zag and see how it all came out. And I chose what to my mind was one of the major moments in Star Wars, a moment that I actually immortalized in a short piece called Skippy the Jedi Droid, in which the R5-D4 unit winds up malfunctioning. And I came up with a story in which the R5-D4 unit did not, in fact, malfunction. And I followed the story from there. And the way that the story wound up going, it ended with Princess Leia was now a Sith Lord and ruling the Empire with an iron fist aided by her young student and consort, Luke Skywalker. And this is going to be a completely demented story, which it has to be if you're going to end it with Luke and Leia as lovers. And I just loved it, and Dark Horse loved it, and we sent it to Lucasfilm, and Lucasfilm had said that they were perfectly okay with this whole storyline. And then they read it, and they came back, and they said, no, you can't do this. It has to end with Luke and Leia saving the day and the Empire being destroyed. And we said, well, that's the end of Star Wars. They said, yes, it has to end like the end of Star Wars. You can't go off in a totally different direction, which frustrated me because, you know, and I said, well, then I'm out because that's not what I wanted to write. And it frustrates me to this day. I mean, the original story was going to be so cool. The cover for issue 3 was going to be Leia with the Darth Maul facial makeup. You know, it was just going to be so freaking cool. We didn't get to do it. And if I had to pick one story of mine that I get frustrated about never having had a chance to see to get to the audience, it would be that one.
Well, do you ever think with the considerable clout that you do have, do you ever try and buy the rights to maybe these stories and publish them yourself? Like, maybe
how can I buy the rights to Star Wars, you know?
Well, I don't mean Star Wars. I mean like maybe the Freddy Kruegers or maybe even make a deal with Marvel or something like that, or whoever happens to own Freddy Krueger, to just print these as a special thing. Because I think, honestly, the Lost Works of Peter David would probably sell quite well.
Well, if you say so. I don't know if people would be that interested.
I think you're underestimating the influence you have and had on the industry.
Okay. Well, we'll have to agree to disagree on that one, but okay.
Well, and then that also brings up, I guess, what my next question would be. Since you work with a lot of licensed properties, do you get that kind of interference regularly, or do you normally have free reign to do whatever you want with X-Factor, the Hulk, Disney, any of the DC characters, or any of the cartoons?
It depends on the licensor. It depends on the property. There are some properties that I have total freedom to do whatever the hell I want. There are other properties where the overseeing of it is extremely stringent and can be an extreme pain in the ass. It really depends upon the respective situation. It even depends upon the people involved. I mean, once upon a time, writing Star Trek was an incredible pain in the ass because of one guy who shall go nameless, Richard Arnold was his name, who worked for Gene Roddenberry, and he made everybody's lives working for Star Trek absolutely miserable. And then he was fired, and suddenly it was much easier to write Star Trek novels. So you see, it really depends upon the people involved.
Well, and then that also, I guess, brings up then, look at, you know, you did those movies for Charles Band, Tranchers 4 and 5 and Oblivion 1 and 2, which, by the way, I think the Oblivion films are incredibly underrated. That's the real Cowboys and Aliens, if you ask me.
Yeah, when they announced Cowboys and Aliens, I'm going, I did that 10 years ago, didn't I?
Charles Band actually re-released the movie as with a very Cowboys and Aliens-esque cover for the Oblivion DVDs, which I thought was kind of shameless, but for Charles Band, kind of right up his alley, too.
Yeah, really.
Now, did you have a good experience on those? Because I noticed you only worked on those four, and that was it, really.
Right.
Is there a reason you didn't do more?
After that, I wound up joining the WGA and then could no longer work for Charlie because he only hired people who were not WGA members.
What did you think about how the movies turned out, all the four of them, the two Oblivions and the two Trancers?
I loved the Oblivion films. I was frustrated by the Trancer movies because Charlie told me to just, you know, have a totally unbridled imagination, just write whatever I wanted to write. He didn't really tell me that we had no budget. I mean, you're thinking a budget of like $1.98. It was frustrating because I wrote these big, sprawling, adventurous epics. And Dave Nutter, who was the director, did the best he could with resources that he had. But there were scenes that were incredibly winnowed down. I mean, the example that I've used to describe it is the following. You know the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark? He goes into the cavern and he grabs the thing and things start shaking and the darts go flying and the rock follows him and he's in the lake and all that stuff. You know that, right?
Yes.
I said, if that were a full moon picture, I want you to envision that you have no money for sets, no money for stuntmen, no money for special effects, no money for extras. The beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark, if it had been filmed by full moon, would have been as follows. Indiana Jones, by himself, in a jungle, creeps up to an outdoor podium on which the thing is set. He creeps up to it, switches it out. The camera starts to shake. Indy looks around and runs. The end. That's the opening of Raiders. You see the problem. It was the same problem in writing Trancers 4 and 5. I wrote these big, brawling, adventurous epics, and maybe a fifth of what I wrote actually got on the screen. That's why the second one was like 65 minutes. They cut all my big adventure stuff, and that was tremendously frustrating. I mean, I will stand right by the screenplays that I wrote because I'm really proud of them. They were not accurately represented in the movie.
Reading in But I Digress that you really wanted Ron Perlman for the Caliban character, too.
Desperately. He auditioned. I was there for his audition. I chatted with him. He's really a cool guy. And his agent, wisely, in my opinion, said, you know, they negotiated for money and they couldn't come to terms on money, probably because Full Moon wasn't actually interested in paying any. And, you know who he had reading for that? Ron Perlman and French Stewart. He read for Caliban's henchmen. They were the guys I wanted. I wanted Ron Perlman for Caliban, French Stewart for Caliban's henchmen. And we got the guys we did, who I thought did a perfectly good job, but they didn't bring it to the level that a Ron Perlman and a French Stewart would have been able to bring it to.
Now, what is the difference between those two and the Oblivion movies, which seemed to have a lot of money, because those had such a huge cast, tons of costumes, effects. You got Andrew Divoff as Red Eye, Munsta Vander, I'm sure I just butchered her name, as Lash.
Instead of Vander, yes.
What was the difference between the Oblivions and
Trancers? We had George Takei, baby. That was a great experience. They had money for those. I don't know where Charlie Band got the money for it, but the two Oblivion movies, which were filmed simultaneously, he actually had a few million dollars to spend. I don't know how he had a few million dollars to spend, but he did. You know, we had an actual Western set, which was kind of unusual. We had Julie Newmar, for God's sake. Carl Steichen was wonderful. I mean, we had a terrific cast. And I don't know whether they just all agreed to work for next to nothing or whether he actually had money to pay these folks. But it was a hoot and a half. I mean, Oblivion was actually fulfilled the storyline as I wrote it. I was kind of astounded. Nothing was cut from the two screenplays that I wrote. We were really astounded when he actually found the money to give us our effects with giant monsters at the end of the second movie. I mean, you know, we actually had giant monsters. I couldn't believe it.
Why did you then agree to work on the Oblivions after the experience on Trancers? I mean, even though it turned out in your favor, did you kind of feel that your Oblivion scripts
Because by the time I was working on Oblivion, I had not seen Trancers yet.
Oh, so you didn't know how
they
turned out
yet. Remember, I was only in Romania for a week or two. I was totally unaware of how much had been cut.
Okay.
And how much had not been filmed.
Have you ever tried to make other movies with whether it's Charles Band or not? Because I see you've got a lot of scripts for TV. Like, I personally would have really liked to have seen your X-Files script, especially season one X-Files. I think that would have been really interesting.
That would have been cool, but it didn't go anywhere.
What do you think of when people look at your work from the newer stuff to the 90s stuff, when they look at your work and it always seems to have a lighter tone to it? And I'm not saying that in a derogatory way, but I mean, mm-hmm. like your Hulk run, you had characters killed. I mean, yeah, you had Marla killed by a female Norman Bates, basically.
Yes.
And yet it never felt heavy. It never felt dark. It always, maybe it was Dale Keown's artwork. The Hulk run got very dark. I mean, there was one point, I remember the Hulk had all the skin flayed off of his bones.
Oh, yeah.
And it never feels dark. Is that something you intend to do, or is that just your style?
I suppose it's my style. I mean, I tend to manage to see the levity in even the most dire situations. In all regards, I mean, when I had my stroke in Florida and they were taking me in an ambulance from one facility to the other, I was cracking jokes in the ambulance. At one point, the doctor told me that I'd had a cardiac episode, and I said, worst episode ever, you know. I just tend to find the humor in situations, even when the situation doesn't really seem to call for it, I guess.
Speaking of that, you had your stroke. You sound mm-hmm. like you're very quite well recovered. Has that altered how
you write? I'm not talking
right?
on one side of my mouth, if that's what you mean.
Well, no, I mean, has it altered how you write? Because I remember when Frank Frazetta had his stroke, he had to teach himself to paint with his other hand.
No, I mean, for a while I couldn't type with any speed because my right hand was more or less dead. I have since managed to come back and I can now type at a normal speed, so that's good. It took me a while to manage to recover my typing ability.
Well, and speaking of typing, one of the things I always loved was, but I digress. Honestly, that was the only reason I bought Comic Buyer's Guide by the mid-90s. Huh. Comic Buyer's Guide, to me, was you buy But I Digress and there's other stuff in it, too. And I have the collections as well. Does it hurt you that But I Digress, at least in Comic Buyer's Guide, is no longer being published, or was it kind of a relief after that many years to not have that on your schedule as well?
I really thought that But I Digress would last a year or two. It never occurred to me that I would be writing it nonstop for 20 years. And the world has changed to such a degree that I think that was having less. I mean, it used to be that I would write something in But I Digress and it would have tremendous impact. And that really wasn't happening anymore. People seem to be paying like less and less attention to it, to the point where I was really wondering if there was any point in doing it anymore. And then the magazine folded, and that was pretty much that. I didn't even know it was going to be going away. I mean, I literally got a memo that said, hi, we just put out our last issue. It was nice working with you. And I'm going, huh? You know, I had absolutely no warning at all.
Would have been nice if you got a final column or something.
Well, I did actually get a final column. I wrote it for the publication Alter Ego. That just came out. So if you want to read my final But I Digress column, feel free to pick up Alter Ego. It's there.
Have you ever thought about doing a third reprint book volume?
Well, I was disappointed with the sales on the second reprint volume. I mean, it's really weird. People kept telling me they want to see a new But I Digress costume. They want to see it. They want to see it. We put it out and they didn't buy it.
I did.
Yeah, oh, good. Excellent. Most people did not. And it was very frustrating because I'm going, you know, what the hell, guys? You said you want to see it. We put it out. You didn't show up. And, you know, I consider that to be a little bit discouraging. On the other hand, I have people encouraging me to actually put out a chronologically accurate, but I digress, collect. You know, literally just collect all of the strips, all of the columns in sequence. I don't know if I should do that or not. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I don't really know if it needs to be reprinted. I mean, does anyone really give a damn about what I thought about a movie from 20 years ago?
Actually,
but
yeah.
You never know.
I was recently rereading the first one. I personally really loved the introductions and the little editor's notes that update, you know, and now it's dated, but update to the printing time of what has come about since then. I thought that was just fascinating look into how things had changed, but maybe I'm unique in that. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. I suppose I could do a chronological thing. I mean, it's something that I'll discuss with my people and see if anyone wants to put that together.
So that was Peter David.
Yes, and he brings up one of the more interesting things about working with licensed characters, what you can't do. Why do you? What are some of the things you think are on the always can't do list? Like, let's just say any franchise, you, Scott Murray, just got the license to write an original book on whatever. What do you think the top things that they're going to say, try to avoid doing is?
Number one is overly eroticize.
That would depend on the franchise, but yeah.
But, well, let's say Harry Potter.
Okay.
Okay. So I've just got the license to write some more Harry Potter fiction, overly sexualize them and everything like that, and, you know, go into the bedroom scenes with Ron and Hermione or Harry and Ron's sister. It's no, you're not going to do that. This is, at its heart, a franchise for kids. Now, if it were you just got the rights to Debbie Does Dallas to write some new Debbie fiction, then
you didn't even need the rights. The sequels weren't licensed. Debbie Does Them All and all that weren't even licensed. So
I realized that, but I was just
I'm just saying I know porn.
The Devil and Miss Jones.
Those are weird ones. They actually were licensed, but they have nothing to do with one another. And the second film's actually kind of a parody of the first one in a strange way. But that's, well, the audience might not.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is it depends on the franchise as to what you absolutely can and cannot do.
I think the biggest one is death. Do not kill such and such supporting character because we may want them in the, quote, official canon later.
There you go.
Do not kill them.
Right. So if I get rights to Star Wars, I'm not going to kill Han Solo.
Yeah, you would not be allowed to do that.
That makes sense.
I think the other big one would be don't add things that aren't there. Like all of a sudden, say you're dealing with a franchise that's relatively grounded in reality, or that has, like, all of a sudden Firefly. All of a sudden they come out with, and remember how there's no aliens in the Firefly universe.
Right.
All of a sudden, an alien race comes down that has giant penises for heads. And you go, well, it's quirky and fun and people like it. And you go, yeah, but it kind of fucks everything else.
It doesn't fit with the universe at all. Or all of a sudden, Han Solo
is a psychic.
He accepts the Force and starts using a lightsaber and becomes...
Yeah.
A badass Luke Skywalker.
Yeah. When you're working with licensed properties, you have to know going in, you've got limitations. And sometimes they seem to ignore that. For instance, like the new Hannibal TV series that's out. It seems like the rights holders said, yeah, you can have Hannibal and Graham and all that. Go wild. We don't care. So you're contradicting every single thing that the books and movies have done previously. We don't care. It's really well rated, so just do whatever you want. Go hog wild.
I tried to watch that series.
My wife likes it. She's watched them all.
I tried. I couldn't. I don't know why. It was just like, no, this isn't. A bit of advice, if you're a fan fiction writer and you're listening to this episode, and I know we have some very good fan fiction writers who listen to our show, for those that are aspiring to do, listen to this, because these limitations are also a mark of good fan fiction versus bad fan fiction.
Well, this isn't even fan fiction. Let's talk a little bit about going into pitching. Like back when Star Trek The Next Generation was on the air, I don't think Deep Space Nine was still on the air yet.
Okay.
Starlog had a cover story on how not to pitch, because remember Star Trek took unsolicited pitches, on how not to pitch a story to Paramount for Star Trek.
Okay.
Because they're like, we would have stories about Khan is somehow still alive and the Genesis device preserved him and he meets Picard. And it's like, okay, no. Not only would that be incredibly expensive, but that requires a specific actor that we would not be able to get. That is a definite, this is how you do not pitch this.
Yeah, that would require a young Ricardo Montalban.
Well, no, he could still be old, because, I mean, Khan was relatively old in Wrath of Khan.
Or, you know, later in the run when he was, yeah, no, when he was just not acting.
No, you'd be able to explain it. Genesis device did it. Because he was in the Genesis explosion when the Reliant blowed up. I'm just saying, you know, there are. I thought that article in Starlog honestly was fascinating on what we are looking for.
Right, that
and
makes
yet,
perfect sense.
And yet, what they said is these are the majority of what we get. The article went on to say that maybe 10% of all the people who sent in plots or finished scripts even made it through the first phase, because it was immediately, okay, I'm three pages into this. No, this is, you know, or people that write giant epic space battles. And it's like, this episode would cost $10 million for what you've written.
It would be
cool.
Do
you not realize how Star Trek is produced?
Yeah. It's one of those where, boy, this would be really, really cool if we had the money to do it.
Exactly.
More often than not, even a successful show has some usually pretty stringent budget limitations.
Exactly. And so when you're working with licenses, you also have to realize that the real world issues. Now, this is talking about TV and that. If you're making a comic book, it's going to cost just as much to have a panel of two people talking as it is an epic space battle.
Right.
So when you're dealing with the drawn, it kind of changes the playing field a little bit in that aspect, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Even the print.
That makes perfect sense. Whether if you're talking about doing a novel, then yeah, it's words or words.
The same number of words go into a dialogue scene as go into a giant space battle between 100 ships.
Exactly. And just like you said, when it comes to drawing panels and publishing a comic book, it doesn't really matter if it's a drawing of two people talking to one another or a drawing of a bunch of spaceships.
Exactly. And so I think what people don't realize is why licensed properties get screwed up so often. Because how many times have you seen the comic book come out of the movie and it's not an adaptation where it's, you know, new adventures of these characters, and people are like, oh God, this is awful. How did X writer go in this direction? Most of the times I think they don't realize that the writer was probably told by the studio or rights holders, we want you to go in this direction and this is where you can't go. So usually in a lot of those cases, the blame is laid on the wrong person. Don't you agree?
Yes and no, because there are also cases where it was just the wrong writer for that project, or a writer, you know, I talked before about a studio going out or a property owner going out and seeking out a writer, and that writer may not always understand the property that he's working with. Gremlins, he may just hear the three rules and that's that, but at the same time not quite understand what makes a Mogwai adorable. So he makes Gizmo already kind of like a trapped cat. You know, he misses the character. It happens.
Or on that same wavelength, you've got, we wanted to get the rights, we couldn't, so we just ripped it off.
With the very close,
you can't sue us because we changed just enough to not get sued.
They're Mogwoos.
Yes. Yes. You know, which that also happens a lot too for licensed stuff, especially in the video game realm.
Oh,
you
sure.
get a lot of that where, yeah, the licenses might be there, but, and then sometimes with licenses, you get weird crossovers. Go to video games for a sec.
Okay.
Have you seen the trailer for the new Call of Duty DLC?
No. Which trailer are you speaking of? I don't really...
I'm not going to tell you what it's called because that'll ruin it, but you're going through the jungle. You hear a...
Okay.
And three little red dots appear, and then a cloaked figure runs at you with two blades out of his arms.
Yeah, Predator thing, huh?
Yes. Call of Duty fights Predators now. They licensed it from 20th Century Fox. And you just go, who thought that was a good idea?
The same people that put Nazi zombies in everything?
Nazi zombies are almost a standby at this point. But, I mean, this was a specific... Not just like, hey, Call of Duty, we're fighting an alien. We're fighting this very specific alien hunter race.
Right.
That is one of those bizarre... That's a weird way to work with licensed characters.
Yeah. Yeah, that's odd. I can see it, but... You know, if they were smart, they would have licensed the alien thing and given people the alien colonial marines that they really wanted.
The one that we should have gotten.
The one that they should have gotten.
Well, you know, you also, before we wrap up, you've also got some of the weird ones like Freddy versus Jason. You know, there's a reason that movie sucked.
They don't work.
Well, not just that, but everybody wanted, I mean, yes, they were both owned by New Line, but each, you know, the people who were producing the Friday the 13th stuff were like, no, Jason's got to win. The people who were producing the Nightmare on Elm Street, no, Freddy's got to win. Yep. You've got two vested interests that are on different sides of the fence.
Yep.
And so it ends up sucking for everybody.
You will never see a satisfying conclusion to that.
Ever. No, you won't. Even the comic which followed it wasn't that good.
Right.
And that brought Ash from Evil Dead into it.
Yes.
And that wasn't very good.
No, it really wasn't. It was a shame. Because Freddy versus Jason versus Ash had potential and could have been great.
Speaking of that, licenses, the ending we didn't get. The ending of that was supposed to be both Freddy and Jason go to hell, chains come out, lock them both against a wall, and Pinhead come out and go, "Gentlemen, is there a problem?" Then the credits were going to come up. They couldn't get the Hellraiser rights from Dimension.
Holy crap.
That seriously was the original scripted ending.
That
would have been pretty cool, you got to admit.
It would have been pretty cool, but then you're just like, my God, how many more licensed things are they just... wow.
Yeah. So, we need to wrap up. Go to adamandeve.com.
Go to amazon.com through our webpage. We have 1201... T-shirts available, not just for Lost in the Static, but for all of the 1201 shows.
As well as a couple of original designs, so it's right. Not just the logos and stuff.
Exactly. And, yeah, thanks for joining us this week.
Well, and you can contact us at lostinthestaticshow@gmail.com, 1201beyond@gmail.com, and I'm going to make you give out your email address. A lot of people that just want to email you. They email me asking for your email address.
Okay, well, you can always contact me on Facebook at facebook.com/smurray75, or it's also smurray, S-M-U-R-R-A-Y, 75, @gmail.com.
See, it's because you're the host. Yeah, apparently I'm only co-host. Nobody wants to talk to me.
Yeah, you're the one with memes. Anyway, we'll see you guys next week.
Yeah, you're the one jealous that I have memes.
Yep.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.